to be an activist?
No, I'm more committed. You know, it was a terrifying experience, but, you know, I know what I signed up for. This is a lifelong thing. You know, even though it does affect us as black people more, I do understand this is a situation that all people in America have to deal with. I'm more committed than I was before. This is going to be a lifelong thing.
And Trevor Aronson, in the last 30 seconds we have, what you want people to take away from this podcast series dropping today, Alphabet Boys?
So I think it's important to recognize that not only did Mickey Windecker try to set up activists like Zeb in specific crimes, but that he played a large role in turning what were otherwise demonstrations and protests into what became full-out assaults on police stations in Denver. Some of the most violent incidents that we saw in Denver that summer had Mickey's fingerprints all over them. He was hyping them up. He was encouraging people to attend. He was encouraging people to become more and more violent. And so, at least in Denver, we have evidence that a government agent was behind many of these protests that ultimately turned violent.
Well, this is a truly astounding podcast series. Trevor Aronson, the host of the new Alphabet Boys podcast, award-winning investigative journalist, contributing writer for The Intercept. Zebedias Hall, thanks so much for joining us from Denver, an activist targeted by the FBI, featured in the podcast, and Mike German for joining us as well, former FBI agent, now a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kvoo.fm.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KVOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually, they'll go insane.
You never know what you will find on your radio / interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
They'll go insane. And eventually...
That's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Eugene bans natural gas in new home construction, Portland is in the running for a new WNBA team, and we hear a global citizen commentary on rising tensions between China and the United States. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 7th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. Eugene will ban natural gas hookups for new residential construction. They're the first city in Oregon to take this step. For new homes and structures under three stories, developers will have to use electric appliances and electric heating in the homes. It was passed in a 5-3 vote by the Eugene City Council Monday night. Councilors said cutting carbon emissions and reducing fossil fuel dependency were part of their reasoning. Eugene Mayor Lucy Yinnis said, quote, "We have a governor who has pledged to build 36,000 new houses this year. We do not want those houses with natural gas hookups, and we can lead the way in the city of Eugene to say this is how it's done," end quote. Councilors had been deciding whether to refer the issue to voters on the ballot, but ended up passing it themselves. There was some dissent, though, including worries that it would discourage developers. President Biden will give his second State of the Union address tonight, and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says the U.S. debt limit is the greatest threat to the country. With those stories and more, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
to acknowledge and meet the American people where they are, but also to try to tell a story about where we are going, where we can go together.
White House National Economic Council Director Brian Deese says President Joe Biden will address the economic uncertainties during today's State of the Union address, but will also aim to foster optimism as the administration celebrates decades low unemployment, decreased inflation, and GDP growth. While inflation has diminished, it still remains high, and this comes as the Fed has also hiked interest rates yet again. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said the national debt is currently the greatest threat to the United States and called on President Biden to address the looming national debt limit and change the government's current spending habits.
Now we must return Washington to a basic truth. Debt matters. The debt limit is one of the most important opportunities Congress has to change course.
On Monday, McCarthy said cuts to Medicare and Social Security are off the table, and defaulting on the debt is not an option, but neither is a future of higher taxes and higher interest rates. McCarthy said negotiations will continue until common ground is found. Vice President Kamala Harris announced almost $1 billion in new commitments by private organizations to support Central American communities as the Biden administration tries to curtail the number of people leaving their home countries for the U.S.
So let us, all of us, as leaders, be it in the private or public sector, agree that we must not politicize this issue.
47 companies and groups are collaborating across various sectors to strengthen economic security in countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. China has accused the United States of using excessive force after shooting down a suspected Chinese spy balloon off the Carolina coast. The move has drawn criticism from Republican lawmakers who said the balloon should have been brought down sooner. State Department spokesperson Ned Price says the decision taken by the Biden administration was a result of China engaging in, quote, an inappropriate, irresponsible, and unacceptable act.
The PRC knows precisely what this was. The PRC knows precisely why this was in our airspace. And ultimately, the PRC knows precisely why we did what we did.
Finally, a prospective staffer has accused scandal-ridden New York Representative George Santos of sexual harassment. Santos denies the allegations made by Derek Myers, who has said he filed a police report over the incident. The complaint has been brought before the House Ethics Committee. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Portland is in the running for one of two WNBA teams the league is looking to add. Senator Ron Wyden met with the league commissioner, Kathy Engelbert, in Northwest Portland to push the city forward as a candidate for a WNBA team. Portlanders, including Portland Thorns general manager Karina LeBlanc, emphasized that the city loves women's sports and basketball. The league will be looking for interest from the local community, but also interest from investors and corporate sponsors. Portland is up against about 20 other cities for two new proposed women's professional basketball teams. It's a few-year process, but the league could be prepared to introduce new teams as soon as 2025 or 2026. A community grant program in Oregon helps to fast-track projects that are oriented towards building community. Eric Tegedoff has more on a success story, a food cart pod in Tigard.
Imagine community projects that can be turned around quickly. Sounds unlikely? A program that does just that is open for applications. Started in 2017, the AARP Community Challenge Program provides grants to improve cities and towns for people of all ages. The city of Tigard is one recent recipient. The program helped fund what's called a Launch Pod Food Business Accelerator. City official Lloyd Purdy says two food cart businesses have been selected and will launch in the spring. He says the Community Challenge Program focuses on projects that build communities.
Whether it's starting new businesses or making a community a healthier place, in my experience, that grant program is willing to put financial support behind a wide range of ideas because AARP knows that a healthy community is good for not just seniors, but for everybody.
Last year, six projects in Oregon were funded through the program. Since 2017, the program has awarded $12.7 million to more than 1,000 projects. The program prioritizes nonprofit organizations and government entities. The Community Challenge Program is adding two new grant programs this year. One is a capacity-building microgrant for improving walkability and starting or expanding a community garden. The other is a demonstration grant that will focus on transportation improvements and the benefits of accessory dwelling units as a housing solution. State Director of AARP Oregon, Vandana Shrestha, says the program as a whole is geared toward fast-tracking ideas that will get tangible results.
Whether it's a community garden that somebody wants to put out or make their park more accessible by putting benches, these may be small grants, but can make a really lasting impact in their community.
In addition to the projects funded by the national organization, Shrestha says the Oregon office was able to provide grants to 4 projects last year and will likely have the capacity to help fund projects again this year. The deadline for applications is 2 p.m. Pacific time on March 15th. Once they're funded, the projects must be completed by November 30th. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The death toll in yesterday's Turkey-Syria earthquake has surpassed 5,000 and it's expected to rise further. The U.S. Geological Survey measured yesterday's quake at a 7.8 magnitude. It extended hundreds of miles long over southeastern Turkey and Syria. Hours later, another quake, likely triggered by the first one, struck some 60 miles away with a 7.5 magnitude. Experts say it was one of the largest earthquakes ever reported in Turkey. Shaking took place for 2 full minutes. The region sits on top of major fault lines and is frequently affected by earthquakes. About 18,000 people were killed in a similarly powerful earthquake that hit northwest Turkey in 1999. Search and rescue teams from around the world arrived in Turkey and Syria today. Because the damage is spread over a wide area, the relief operation has been struggling to reach many affected towns. More than 8,000 people have been pulled from debris in Turkey, and about 380,000 have taken refuge in government shelters or hotels. Families and friends took to social media to plead for assistance for loved ones believed to be trapped under the rubble. Turkish officials said all calls were being, quote, collected meticulously, with the information being relayed to search teams. 13 million of Turkey's population of 85 million were affected in some way. A state of emergency was declared in 10 provinces. The entire quake-hit area probably affected some 23 million people. The United Nations says it's exploring all avenues to get supplies to rebel-held northwestern Syria. That's an area where millions live in extreme poverty and rely on humanitarian aid to survive. The affected area in Syria is divided between government-controlled territory and the country's last opposition-held enclave, which is surrounded by Russian-backed government forces. The rebel-held enclave holds some 4 million people displaced from other parts of the country by the war. Many live in buildings that were already damaged by military bombardment. Turkey has large numbers of troops in the border region with Syria and has tasked the military to aid in the rescue efforts. Sebastian Gay, the Doctors Without Borders head of mission in Syria, said health facilities were overwhelmed with medical personnel working around the clock to help the wounded. Today, February 7th, is National Black HIV and AIDS Awareness Day, and advocates are drawing attention to the fact that disparities in testing and social stigma still remain, even as treatment has progressed significantly. Nadia Ramlagan reports.
Today is National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, and advocates say barriers remain when it comes to testing and social stigma. More than 40% of the people currently living with HIV are Black, despite accounting for only 12% of the U.S. population. Laura Shever with the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the Federal Health Resources and Services Administration says viral suppression treatment in the form of daily medication has allowed most HIV patients to live a successful and near-normal life.
So it's no longer a death sentence. So that's really important. And second, that person cannot transmit HIV sexually to other people. So it's important both for their health and for our work towards ending the HIV epidemic.
Federal data shows more than 87% of Black Americans living with HIV/AIDS are receiving medical care and viral suppression drugs. Shever points out that's a huge increase from the number of Black patients receiving treatment in 2010. According to the CDC, in 2020, North Carolina ranked in the top 10 states for new HIV cases among adults and adolescents, with more than 1,000 residents newly diagnosed, most of whom are Black men. Shever says an ongoing challenge, especially in rural areas and in the South, is encouraging people to get tested.
One in eight people living with HIV don't know they have it, so we need better testing. And we need people to come in care and stay in care. We estimate that of the 1.2 million people with HIV in this country, 250,000 are out of care.
According to research focused on the Deep South, common barriers to testing include transportation cost, not knowing where to receive specialty care, stigma, and concern about others in the community finding out. This is Nadia Ramlagan for North Carolina News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on community control of police. At 6, it's Trans-Positive PDX, then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with less rain showers and a daytime high of 48. Today in history, in 2014, scientists announced the Happisburgh footprints found in Norfolk, England. They say they're over 800,000 years old, making them the oldest human footprints found outside of Africa. The quote of the day is from English writer Charles Dickens, who was born on this day in 1812. He wrote, quote, "There is nothing in the world so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humor." A bill in the South Dakota legislature that would have codified state-level protections for Native children, similar to the Indian Child Welfare Act, failed yesterday. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A pair of South Dakota House bills designed to codify aspects of the federal Indian Child Welfare protections in state law failed to pass on Monday. One of them would have bumped up requirements for the Department of Social Services to keep Native children with their families and tribes. The other outlined placement preferences for children, regardless of race, to keep them in their communities when they're removed from their homes. Victoria Wicks reports.
The bill to give first preference for foster or adoptive placements in communities did not make it through the House Judiciary Committee Monday morning, and the bill to improve DSS efforts died on the House floor later in the day. Opposition in both forums centered on an appeal currently before the U.S. Supreme Court that challenges the constitutionality of the federal ICWA law. On the House floor, Representative Tony Van Huysen said if the Supreme Court finds that ICWA is unconstitutional, the state will have passed potentially unconstitutional laws.
So as important as this issue is, at a time when the law is in flux before the Supreme Court, I would submit that this is not the time to make this change. We should wait and see what happens and consider a law like this next year.
The case, Holland versus Brackeen, questions if preferred placement of Native children with Native families or tribes is race-based rather than political, and if the federal government, by directing state courts to take certain actions, violates anti-commandeering principles. Representative Perry Poirier is the prime sponsor of both bills. She argued against Van Huysen's contention.
We have nine tribal nations. We have citizens of those tribal nations that are South Dakotans. This is not a race-based law.
As for the other aspect, Poirier said the issue there involves federal commandeering of state procedures. She said the state is allowed to commandeer itself by passing these bills. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Yurok tribe is sponsoring a day at the Capitol on Tuesday in Sacramento to address missing and murdered indigenous people. Frankie Myers is vice chair of the tribe.
We're really looking to help, highlight the need for better tribal engagement with the state process and more engagement from the state, and really raise the awareness of MMIP issues here in California.
He says tribes are taking a holistic approach to address MMIP in the state.
We have to make sure that our people are protected. How we make sure that this stays in the focal point of our state partners is continuing to make sure that we're progressing forward with legislation and budget amendments that actually will make change to this epidemic.
Myers says three pieces of legislation they're advocating for would do just that. One involves seeking $200 million added to the governor's budget to address MMIP. The other two bills involve public safety and protections for young people in the foster care system. Montana tribes are among tribes receiving federal water settlement funds, which were announced last week. Aaron Bolton reports the funding comes from an infrastructure bill passed by Congress last year.
The Interior Department is allocating $460 million in order to meet the federal government's financial obligation to tribes across the country with water compacts. Another $120 million will go toward the Reclamation Water Settlement Fund. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in northwest Montana will receive the largest disbursement at nearly $157 million. The tribes have the largest water compact in U.S. history at $1.9 billion. Funding will also flow to other Montana tribes, including the Blackfeet Nation and the Crow Tribe. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Conservation groups are applauding a new plan for the Colorado River, which addresses the climate change disruptions on the state's water supply. The Colorado River Basin states recently failed to come together in a water reduction management plan. It's estimated that 70% of the water in the Colorado River originates in Colorado. Eric Galatis has more.
A coalition of conservation groups are giving Colorado's revised state water plan a thumbs up for its increased focus on protecting Colorado's rivers, watershed health, and accessibility for all residents, regardless of their zip code. Matt Rice with the group American Rivers says the new plan highlights the urgent need to address the impacts of climate change on Colorado's water resources and lays out a playbook for advancing projects, policies, and programs to build resilience.
There's a lot of emphasis put on watershed health. How do we support our forests so they produce more and better water, so they mitigate the impacts of catastrophic wildfire and protect habitat?
Rice notes the plan's focus on water conservation as a starting point is essential for meeting the water needs for the state. This year's higher than average snowpack is not expected to reverse a 23-year drought, nor a future expected to bring warmer summers, more evaporation, and earlier runoff of waters that 40 million people living in Colorado River Basin states depend on. The now official Colorado Water Plan builds on the first iteration created in 2015, which saw some 30,000 people participate. Rice says for the first time ever, policymakers called out the importance of river flows for the environment and outdoor recreation. He adds that state investments in the plan would help tap hundreds of millions in federal dollars for local water projects statewide.
We worked hard as a coalition to make sure that the projects that funded environmental benefits, recreational projects, had adequate funding. One of the challenges in the first water plan was that there was about a $3 billion funding gap.
About 70% of water flowing through the Colorado River originates in Colorado, and Rice says the state's new plan recognizes the multiple benefits of keeping rivers healthy by keeping them clean, full, and flowing.
River-based recreation, whether that's boating or fishing, is a huge economic driver for rural Colorado. $18 billion a year, and that's significant.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
A recent rash of whale deaths in New York and New Jersey has been wrongly blamed on offshore wind farms. Elected officials in both states say they think it's important to cut through that misinformation. Edwin J. Vieira has more on the story.
Misinformation about the impacts of offshore wind turbines on marine life could derail offshore wind farm projects in New York and New Jersey. The issue stems from a string of whale deaths in both states that occurred over the last 2 months. Experts said there's no link between offshore wind turbines and harm to whales, but misinformation has continued to spread. More than 165 New York elected officials signed a letter from elected officials to protect America in support of offshore wind. But Albany County legislator William Reinhart notes there have been concerns about the development of a manufacturing facility at the Port of Albany. He feels any environmental impacts need to be addressed immediately.
As you develop your wind facilities, whether it's the port or the facilities themselves out in the ocean, you don't want to fall into the pattern of the fossil fuel industry, which is to create an awful lot of pollution, much more than you ever would with wind. But still, you want to follow environmental guidelines, take care of Mother Nature and all that.
Reinhardt feels the best way to inform people is to present the science as clearly as possible to ensure people have a better understanding of offshore wind. Currently, New York has 4,300 megawatts in offshore wind farms under development. This is part of a goal to have 9,000 megawatts of offshore wind powering the state by 2035. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, several mayors of towns along the Jersey Shore have called for a moratorium on offshore wind. Atlantic County Commissioner Karen Fitzpatrick finds the majority of people have accepted offshore wind, but she notes a loud minority is eager to change all that. Fitzpatrick thinks this debate has become an allegory for the country's current divisiveness.
We are so divided and so tribal that a lot of people will not listen to another point of view or another perception, even when it is substantiated by hard fact.
She adds, in order to cut through the shouting of the minority, there need to be town hall meetings and other information sessions with people who are more knowledgeable about offshore wind. Fitzpatrick hopes it will help people see the real benefits to offshore wind and dispel any lies about the projects. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
International observers had thought that relations between the United States and China were thawing. But Secretary Blinken dropping out of his trip to China and the weather balloon incident have shattered those expectations. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In the aftermath of President Biden's summit meeting with China's President Xi Jinping last November in Bali, a number of commentators saw signs of a warming of U.S.-China relations. They pointed, for instance, to upcoming visits to Beijing by Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other top U.S. officials. Any chance of a warming trend has been literally shot down. But in fact, the troubling signs were much more significant than the warming signs even before the Chinese surveillance balloon was discovered over Montana, resulting in postponement of Blinken's trip and then the shooting down of the balloon off the Carolina coast. Taiwan remains a flashpoint as Chinese jets periodically fly close to Taiwan's airspace, U.S. military aid to Taiwan ratchets up, and House of Representatives Republicans call for the U.S. to recognize Taiwan as an independent nation, a red line for Beijing that would likely mean war. Meanwhile, Xi and Vladimir Putin have held another meeting, at which Xi repeated his support of Putin's narrative on the Ukraine war. Japan has issued a new strategic plan, my previous broadcast, that casts China as a strategic enemy. And Wang Yi, China's most important foreign affairs official, has declared that the U.S. has failed to fulfill promises with respect to non-interference in China's internal affairs and building security partnerships that target China. To Chinese leaders, the U.S. is less interested in dialogue than in maintaining what it calls a Cold War mindset. In short, even had Blinken traveled to Beijing, we should not expect much from high-level meetings between Chinese and U.S. officials these days. Their agendas are far apart. The U.S. wants improvements in China's human rights practices, transparency on China's plans for increasing its long-range missile arsenal, cooperation on dealing with North Korea, revival of military-to-military communications, and a recommitment to large purchases of U.S. agricultural goods. But the Chinese want broad statements of principle governing mutual respect and non-interference in each other's affairs. Specifically, that means the U.S. should stop sanctioning their officials and companies responsible for the repression in Xinjiang and Hong Kong, and should end U.S. efforts to decouple the two economies, notably through the CHIPS war that has blocked Chinese access to semiconductor technology in the U.S. and in some U.S.-allied countries. China also wants visa restrictions on its researchers lifted. Most of all, China wants the U.S. to stop violating the One China principle that Biden says he upholds, violating it by having high officials visit Taiwan. Kevin McCarthy is scheduled to be next, and by increasing military aid and training. These different agendas speak to the fundamental difference in U.S. and Chinese perspectives on national security. While the U.S. surveys ways to make the world safe for its political and economic order, China sees internal order as central to its international security, including what it sees as external threats that disrupt internal order. Just now, that internal order has been shaken by the failure of Xi's zero COVID policy and the mounting infections, by a suddenly weak economy, and by the need at great expense to build its own semiconductor industry. To these internal concerns should be added setbacks abroad, such as the costly Belt and Road Initiative and relations with India, Japan, and the European Union. Beijing may be more sensitive than usual to U.S. demands, particularly when U.S. officials, such as Kurt Campbell, the White House so-called czar on Indo-Pacific strategy, says, quote, the worst thing for China is a hostile relationship with the U.S. Was he signaling that the U.S. intends to take advantage of China's internal weaknesses? Memo to Campbell, such pressure tactics don't work with China. Under Joe Biden, and probably contrary to Chinese expectations, a liberal administration is carrying out a chips war, an ideological war, democracy versus autocracy, and a trade war with China, all while also carrying out a real war with Russia over Ukraine. Those policies are not only a recipe for constant international instability, they do not serve the American people. They mean, for example, a $1 trillion military budget in the near future to finance confronting dual adversaries. Economically, as Henry M. Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, wrote recently in Foreign Affairs, decoupling the U.S. and Chinese economies harms U.S. businesses and consumers while also alienating the U.S.'s most important allies. Joe Biden and his national security team need to take a step back from obsession with the China threat and give diplomacy a chance. Kurt Campbell should have added that the worst thing for the U.S. is a hostile relationship with China, since the U.S. needs Chinese cooperation if any progress is going to be made on the climate crisis, pandemics, and nuclear weapons. The balloon incident is an ugly reminder of how badly frayed U.S.-China relations are, but it also should underscore why we have diplomats and why we should be using them to engage China. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 7th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Eric Galatis, Nadia Romlagon, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.